spread that education or to look more into it and to ultimately to deploy you to work with at-risk teens. Help One Child has a much broader umbrella than you're going to hear about today. We work through hundreds of churches. We recruit and train and support, as it says, anybody who's willing to help with an at-risk youth. Pretty much we fill the gap between what social services can provide and what is actually needed to raise a child, to increase the outcomes. The outcomes are pretty grim for children who come through the foster care system. There's some interesting language on here, and you may not be sensitive to it. 3,400 children receiving services in our region today. That can mean that those children are still in the home where someone reported abuse or neglect. That can mean that they're with a relative, an unsuspecting relative who suddenly has them in their care. Not everyone comes into the foster care system. Major decrease in the last 12 months of children in foster care. Many of them are still experiencing abuse and neglect. They probably won't be removed, a good number of them. Why? Because most of them are teenagers. We think about these as children, and they're really teenagers for the most part. And that's who we really want to focus on today, those teens that are still out there. Why? Because if you looked at these kinds of statistics, if you were experiencing this, what might you do? You might run away. You might expose yourself to the street. And these kids are ill-equipped to be on the street, even more so than a mainstream teen. We find that if people don't take the time to bond with a child, this doesn't mean you have to be their parent, but if you don't take the time to bond with a child, or a child doesn't have that opportunity, I should say, they just start going downhill. The cost of these things, the homelessness, the early pregnancy, the drug and alcohol abuse, incarceration, the cost of that has been quantified at somewhere between 1.7 and 2.6 million per child. The services that are required. This is our criminal population, those that emancipate without bonding. There are 70% of San Quentin inmates, former foster children. 100%, I just read, serial killers, former foster children who have been abused and neglected. It's incredibly sad. And why wouldn't it be so? The first stranger that these children come in contact with is the parent that turns a blind eye to them. That's the first stranger they come in contact with. And after that, it's pretty clear. They're going to be in and out of different residential environments, and those are the lucky ones that have a home, that are receiving services that are taken from the abusive or neglective situation that they've been in. So many of our teens end up over here in ITFC homes and group homes. That's just, you know, extended special needs care that happens for these children. Our goal is to create a task force that, and you can be part of a task force that educates, even if you just have your own teenagers. Because what we want to get into today is, what is predator behavior? And why is it? Why are these kids more vulnerable? What is it about them? Well, it's their inability to attach, their fear of bonding. This creates disorders of attachment. And what our fear is that because there's such a decrease, such a trend right now, directly related to a reduction in government funding, that there's going to be more and more of these teens. When they're in a group home, they can't be kept. They can come and go. And so it's up to them to stay and receive services. So if we can get to these kids that are in group homes and help them understand what it is about themselves that makes them more vulnerable, that makes them actually attracted to predators, and teach them about that as well as how to recognize a predator, then I think we've got something we might be able to impact. Now I'm going to turn this discussion over to Linda Ikeda. She is very well qualified to talk about attachment and what happens, what's supposed to happen in our life. Linda, while we make the switch here.
We'll see what happens. Okay. Can you hear me? No. So maybe I need to put the microphone up a little bit. The placement of our podium makes it a little bit difficult to have our notes there, so please don't mind if we're walking around with them. Can you hear any better this way? Okay. Oh, it's just recording. Okay. So if I start getting quiet, would you raise your hand and let me know, or put your hand behind your ear? I'm Linda Ikeda, and I'm delighted to be here because I'm getting to talk about something I'm really passionate about, and that is attachment. So all of us were created to belong. We are actually hardwired neurologically to be in relationships with other people. It's a basic human need for us to belong in a trusting relationship. And trust is learned actually in the attachment relationship. When trust doesn't go well, when a child is not attaching well, that impacts their brain development, impacts all the ways that they see future relationships. So what is attachment? Attachment is something that actually begins in the womb. By the time a baby is born, she or he knows the sound of his mother's voice, knows the kind of music mom likes to listen to. If mom is being beaten, the baby is being beaten. And if mom is using drugs or alcohol, the baby is using them too. Babies know the sound of their mother's heartbeat, and if there has been a father or another person regularly close to the mother, the baby knows that parent's voice as well. I'm going to show you two brief video clips. The reason I'm showing you two is because the first time I saw these clips, I thought, oh, that was totally staged. These clips are from two different hospitals, different times in history, but you're going to see a newborn baby and the way it recognizes its parents. So, could we?
Newborns show a clear ability to remember sounds heard before birth. As early as the 6 month of pregnancy, Nancy's baby could feel the vibrations of the outside world and react to the sound of his mother's voice. Around the middle of the 7th month, he could actually begin to recognize different speech intonations. Given a choice, newborns will choose the familiar, comforting tones of their mother's voice again and again.
And one more clip.
Eyes wide, face searching, all senses tuned. To recognize and capture the most important people in his life, his parents. And parents are ready to respond.
You and me.
Dr. Barry Brazelton shows a mother that her day-old infant prefers her voice. And mom can't help but be affected. It's the same with fathers, too. Doctor and dad compete. It's the beginnings of what's called attachment. The bonding that science now knows is the most critical factor in the baby's development.
Parents who fall in love with little children and children who fall in love with their parents. And the beginning of the love relationship between parents and their children is probably the most important thing that parents do.
So, one of the things that this last narrator said is that children who fall in love with parents have parents who fall in love with them. And that points out something really important about the attachment relationship, and that's that it's reciprocal. So it goes both ways. And if a child even is relinquished for adoption, even at birth, or separated from mom because mother is very ill, or the baby is very ill, this affects their attachment because that's a real disruption. It's not what they're expecting. Attachment is the foundation of all brain development. Some of our genes are activated or silenced in the context of the attachment relationship. And then as we get into the teen years, there's another vulnerable, critical window in brain development, and genes are activated or not activated because of the environment that that teenager is in. That's called epigenetic regulation. The attachment relationship is the basis for all trust, the very foundation of trust. And it's the template or the pattern for all future relationships. It's how we seek out relationships in the future, and it is the pattern for what we expect relationships to be like. When infants are securely attached, they know what to do with parents. So they want to be close to their parents, because they see the parent as a secure base or a refueling station, as you will. When they are afraid or needing comfort, they turn to their parents because they know that the parents are going to be there to help them with whatever the situation is. It doesn't feel good to be separated for long periods of time from the attachment figure. And one thing I should have said at the beginning, I may be talking about mother, but I want you to know that the attachment figure is whoever is most consistently meeting the baby's needs, particularly in the first year of life. So that can be father, grandparent, it can be a foster parent, it can be daycare. My favorite characteristics of attachment is that a child, if they are attached well and know that there is someone that they can return to, they're free to explore their environment. So if you think about a daisy, the center of the daisy is the attachment figure. And as a child is able to start being mobile when they start crawling or sitting up or something, they actually will move away from the parent as if they're a petal on that daisy. But then when they need to be refueled, they turn back, they see their attachment figure there, and then they move back. And this kind of exploring is very characteristic of a healthy attachment relationship. If a parent is punishing for when a child moves away from them, and when the child comes back says, "You left me, see how you like being by yourself," then that child is not going to feel very free to explore. Or if the parent is highly anxious and is hovering over the child is not going to be as free to explore. Regulation, which is just another word to say being able to calm and self-soothe, is actually learned in the attachment relationship. If you think about a baby who's crying, what most of us do is we will pick that baby up, we'll pat them on the back, and we'll say, "It's okay, mommy's here." And that is how children internalize the ability to soothe and calm themselves. Attachment occurs in the first year of life through the cycle of trust. We say that, and we're talking about the first, the first 12 years, first 12 months, obviously, but we say that an infant is all needs. When a baby is born, there's nothing that they can do for themselves. They can't feed themselves, they can't change themselves, they can't comfort themselves when they get upset. and they're hardwired, we're born with the ability to cry, and that's how they signal us. And we call, when a child is signaling through crying, we call that a dysregulation. So that's the lack of this calm, soothed experience. And those of us who have raised babies know that we begin to learn that our children have different kinds of cries. There's one cry for I need to lay down for a nap. There's another cry for I'm hungry. There's another cry for I'm in pain. And as we meet the needs of our infants, they become regulated again. Now, if you are an orphanage worker and you have a different set of infants every day, or if you have more than three infants in your care, it's going to be very difficult for you to be able to read the baby and what the baby's needs are. We call this attunement, being in harmony with or synchrony with, and so the needs may not be met adequately. But in the best case scenario, the parent more often than not meets the needs of the child, the child becomes regulated, and this is how trust is born. When you think about it, during the first year of life, this cycle happens thousands and thousands of times. So it's not that a parent needs to be absolutely perfect, but most consistently, meeting the child's needs is what builds a cycle of trust. And when a baby has learned to trust, they see themselves as valuable, they know that their needs are important, they know that you as the attachment figure see their needs and will meet them, and therefore it's safe to ask for help. They know how to calm themselves. When attachment does not go well, children don't know what to do with parents. They don't know that staying close to a parent can help them and provide a feeling of safety. They don't know that anybody really sees or cares about their needs. And this develops in the child something we call chronic self-reliance. That means I am the belief that I am the only one who can meet my needs. Children don't know, who haven't learned to trust, don't know that relationships can be repaired when there's been a rupture. Because the repairing of relationships is, as we'll see, actually occurs during learning this, is something that begins to be learned in the second year of life. If attachment has not occurred, a child will not know that a relationship can be repaired. And lastly, a child does not learn how to calm and soothe themselves, how to regulate themselves in appropriate kinds of ways. Children are very adaptable, and they learn other ways of doing it, but they're not socially acceptable. And when attachment does not go well, we begin to see disorders of attachment or attachment challenges. So let's look at that first year cycle where the trust is disrupted and is not occurring. The first two steps are the same. Baby still has all needs. They still cry and become dysregulated to let us know that they need something. And then instead of the needs being met appropriately, maybe the child is silenced by being hit or yelled at. Or maybe the infant is neglected and they learn that asking for something is fruitless, and so they don't cry anymore. And when this kind of situation happens over and over and over again, trust is not learned. And the child, even in infancy, begins to operate with a belief that the only one they can trust is themselves. And if I am the only one I can trust, then that means I need to be in control of everything, which is where some of the behavior issues we see in older children come from. if I have been a victim of this kind of first year of life, I don't know that I'm important. I believe that my needs are not important, and I can't trust that you will either see them or meet them. And therefore, I have to be in control in order to feel safe. See, it's really about the feeling of safety, which is what helps us feel calm and regulated. And so, of course, there's going to be difficulty in regulation. I'm going to show you a little bit longer video clip. It's going to be about 3 minutes. You'll totally be able to tell what era it is because of the hairstyles and the attire. But it's called the Visual Cliff Experiment. And what you're going to see is you're going to see a table that is actually made out of all glass. But half of the table is painted in a checkerboard fashion, and the other half is just the glass with certain kind of lighting underneath it so there's no reflection in the glass. And we're going to see a baby start out on the solid part of the glass and be beckoned by a parent. And I just think this is a beautiful picture of trust.
Working with the cliff to explore whether parents, by facial expression alone, can change the behavior of their children. Joseph Campbell began by trying to determine if one type of fear, namely fear of heights, is innate.
With the underneath illumination, the child cannot see any reflection of himself. The glass surface is invisible.
Come here.
He doesn't seem to show any facial expressions of fear.
Oh, what a good boy you are.
Here he comes. It's the banana.
Come on.
Ooh. And this baby, as you can see, he shows very little wariness of height as he crosses the deep side of the cliff to his father. As we're more than 300...
Isn't that a great little clip? That child believes, my dad thinks I can walk on air, therefore I can walk on air. So during the second year of life, some really important things happen. A child begins vocalizing more clearly with intention, and also they become more mobile. So by the end of the first year, most babies are crawling. And about 12 to 16 months, the majority of infants are walking. But when a child becomes, when these little toddlers become more mobile, they can get themselves into a lot of trouble, can't they? Because children this age are extremely curious, and they have more of the ability to begin to do something about their curiosity. And so this is when parent freedom really ends, because you're having to watch your child all the time. But it is in this second year that conscience development begins, learning the difference between right and wrong, and beginning to accept authority. And when you think about our teenagers who are acting out and at risk, who have not had a good attachment, accepting authority, learning that no exists, repairing relationships, and conscious development, these are all issues. So the second year cycle, I call it, I see it, I want it, I take it, it's mine. And the first difference we have in the second year is now, instead of just having needs, the toddler is now beginning to have wants. To follow a ball into the street, is that a need or a want? And of course, the toddler doesn't know any difference. They just know that my ball is going and I'm following it. So a child has a want, and then let's use the example of a ball going into the street. And dad yells, "No, stop!" Dad's scared. And the child will look back and see dad's face. And dad, he doesn't recognize that look, because most of us, when we're around babies, you know, they're just so cute, and we all talk in a different kind of voice and everything, you know, and it just makes us smile. But dad is really scared and wants to make an impression, and so how is his face going to look? It's not going to be that happy face. This does not feel good to the child, and that creates an experience for him that the relationship is ruptured, like it's over and broken. And because the child has learned to trust, and this is really key, if trust has not occurred in the first year, we don't achieve this. And the reason for that is we have to have an attachment figure that we want to please. So all the talk we do these days about codependency and everything, in the second year of life, pleasing is necessary and important. And because I want to please my father and see that happy face again so that I can feel good, I'm going to accept his no and the limit that he set. And that is going to give us a feeling of reunion or repair in our relationship. And this is how we learn right from wrong. Learn that relationships can be repaired, and also learn to accept authority. All really important skills. How much time do I have left?
1 minute.
1 minute. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Okay, cortisol. I think the important thing with this slide is knowing when cortisol is released in our brains, it's like the experience, the feeling we have is, do you remember as a kid when somebody jumped out behind a door to scare you and how your heart starts beating fast and it comes up in your throat? When our kids are feeling unsafe, our teenagers, they are in this cortisol surge all the time. So they're feeling the fight, flight, or freeze response. And these are some of the different ways they're manifested in teenagers. When that happens, the executive functioning of our brain or prefrontal cortex completely shuts down. So we don't have the ability to learn from experience, to have empathy, to be reciprocal in relationships, to problem solve, and so on. And it's very important for us to understand that children who have not attached well are in a constant state of high arousal. We call that, and they see the world only in dangerous ways. We call that paratactic distortion. So how healing is attained? The easy answer, the complex answer, is it's all about relationships. Relationships change our brain. They teach us about ourselves. They help us to develop reciprocity, problem solving, empathy. But the important thing here is to know that it's a specific kind of relationship. It's what we call an intersubjective relationship, and that's just a fancy word for the experience of feeling felt, feeling like somebody really gets me. This kind of relationship is felt at a deeper level. It's kind of a resonance that we feel in our gut. These kind of communications, intersubjective, actually help to shape and organize our brain through increasing neural networks. So it's the experience I have of you have an impact on me, and that changes my brain. And the fact that my brain, that you have had an impact on you, changes your brain. And it releases neurotransmitters, which is good stuff, in our brains. We were created to belong. We're hardwired to connect. We know this because of the advances in neuroscience. And this is really a reflection of the attachment that God meant us to have with himself, this perfect relationship. Our parents aren't perfect, so we get kind of messed up in the process. But God is really the ultimate example of someone who is subjective with us, because he really gets us. And we know that attachment to God changes our brain. It's all about relationships. God knows it. He prescribes it and offers it. And we, the three of us, are recommending it as an important way of helping at-risk foster teens. And it's at this time that I'd like to pass the mic over to an expert in how to help that happen.
Okay.
This advances and that makes it go back. Okay, great. Thank you.
Great, thank you. My name is Sarah Kremer, and I'm Program Director of Friends for Youth Mentoring Institute. Thank you all for being here today, and I'm really excited to be part of this session. So I'm going to talk a little bit about mentoring, and I know we wanted to save some time for conversation. So there's a lot of information in my slides. You know that there's a formula about how much you remember and retain from presentations. So I think I try to push my odds a little by including a lot. I'm not going to go over it all, but it's all here in the paper. And if you didn't get a handout, I think they're trying to get some more. So you will have it later. Okay, so Friends for Youth, we're located in Redwood City, which is in San Mateo County. And our vision is transforming lives through the power of mentoring relationships. And our mission is to create quality mentoring relationships for youth who need them the most. We do this through our mentoring services program. We've matched about 1,800 young people now in San Mateo and Santa Clara counties with an adult volunteer for a one-to-one community-based mentoring relationship. We have our mentoring institute, which is what I do, and I go out and train other programs, share what we've learned over the past 32 years, and support other programs in doing it the right way. This is a definition of mentoring that we use a lot. I'll let you read it. How many people have had a mentor in their lives? Somebody who felt as if you mattered, you were special, they cared about you, someone besides a parent. Raise your hand again. Okay, that's a good number. How many people are a mentor right now to someone else? Okay, that's a smaller number. It's really important to go out and to be a mentor, even if it's not through a formal program, but informally connect with a young person, help them see that they are special, that they have something to offer to the world. Brief history of mentoring. This is really a way to show mentoring's been around for an awfully long time, right? Back from when Homer wrote the Odyssey. Lots of variations of how it's happened. What we think of today as modern mentoring really started at the beginning of the 1900s. And there are nothing much happened for about 75 years in the formal mentoring world. And then some research started happening and other organizations started to be formed to really support this idea of a formal mentoring program and how that's different from natural mentoring. I will say that there's a lot of things that are happening at the bottom that are still continuing now. Does anyone know when National Mentoring Month is? No. Any guesses?
Right now.
That's it. January is National Mentoring Month. This is the 10th year that January is National Mentoring Month, and I know I just heard that it's also the month to bring awareness to human trafficking, too, which is an interesting correlation there. And next week, on Tuesday, I'll be at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. for a National Mentoring Summit. So there are a lot of people who really put support behind youth mentoring and what it does. There are a lot of different kind of models. Most people think of mentoring as big brothers, big sisters, which is a one-to-one model, but there are a number of other ways to do it now that are really coming out, including peer-to-peer mentoring, which is a pretty big shift in how you think about what a mentor can do and who's really being served. But no matter what kind of model you use and what kind of structure it is, what kind of program it is, it's really about that relationship that Linda was talking about. If you don't have that relationship, you're not going to really form that mentoring relationship. It is the intervention. That is what mentoring does. These are some photos from our program of a mentor and his mentee at the top. That's, his wife was also a mentor, matched with a mentee. They're brother and sister, the mentees. This was about 6 years ago, and I actually matched them in our program. This was taken last June, so it had been 6 years since they had first met. And the mentors had two children, and they still see their mentees, who are brother and sister. So I really love this example of it's, you know, it's a long-term relationship. It doesn't mean they still see them every week, but they still have a connection to them. And these young people know that there are other adults out there in the community who really care about them and who want to see them do well. So that's what we believe in. Mentoring is a developmental intervention. So some of the things that Linda was talking about in terms of attachment, this is really key to mentoring because you're forming a relationship with an adult, or sometimes a peer, but it's a reparative relationship. It's something that you can do to change maybe the way that you've had relationships before. What's really important about this is that mentors need to be carefully screened so that they are appropriate role models and appropriate attachment figures. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. This is another way to look at it within a relational framework. There's a researcher in Boston, Renee Spencer, who does some really great qualitative work on mentoring. And I pulled out one of the slides I usually do. So would someone mind reading the top quote? This is from a mentee. It's part of her research. Okay.
So I was like not telling her anything. I was telling her some stuff, yeah. But then we started seeing each other, so I tell her more stuff, like about me and what I do and stuff like that.
Okay. Can someone read the bottom, please?
Okay. You have to be real with me, you know. I can't get close to nobody without them being real with me, you know. And without you being real with me, you can't get close with me. You brought it to me real, so I was like, okay.
Does that sound like any teenagers you know, the way they're talking? So it's very authentic, and it's also capturing that idea of what's important in mentoring relationships is what mentors bring is authenticity. They are who they are. They're not trying to be anyone else. They're not trying to be a cool peer. They're not trying to be a parent. They're not trying to be anything else but who they are. Then they'll be able to form that relationship. So that's another key point. Mentoring also supports resiliency research. This is from a couple youth mentoring researchers. Resilient youth are consistently distinguished by the presence of caring adults in their lives. So that's not really any surprise to anyone who's done any work with young people. This is from a social worker who's done a lot of work in resiliency. Could someone else read this one too, please? I saw a hand go up in the back. Someone else was interested in volunteering.
I see what is right with you. No matter what you have done in the past, no matter what problems you currently face, your strengths are more powerful than your risks. And whatever risk, problem, or adversity you are facing are steps on the road to bouncing back. They are not the end of the road.
That's the attitude that we want mentors to hold. Thank you for reading that. This is the attitude we want our mentors to hold when they're working with young people. It's to not get caught up in, oh, you messed up this again, you failed at that. They have plenty of other people saying that to them in their lives. They don't need somebody else. So we train mentors to really try to keep this in mind. It can be very difficult some days, but to really try to come back to this concept when they're connecting with their mentee. So what does mentoring do? We know what it, if a young person does not have a mentor, if they don't have one, they're more vulnerable to a whole host of difficulties, academic failure to involvement in serious risk behaviors. So mentoring is preventative in a way. It's an intervention. And from some of the research, we know that young people who do have mentoring relationships, they do experience a lot of positive benefits. You can see better school attendance and attitude, better chance of higher education, preventing substance abuse, reducing negative risk behaviors, more positive social relationships, trust and communication more with parents, and they experience more emotional support from their friends. You'll notice it does not say better grades at school. That's one thing I know a lot of funders are probably really interested in seeing. It's not something that we see in a mentoring relationship right away. It's something that that kind of happens over time. But if you start with better school attendance, at least they're showing up, and better attitude, they're going to be more open to it as they get older. And then a last slide on mentoring impacts. You see more significant associations between involvement in mentoring relationships and positive developmental outcomes, including reduced delinquency, gang involvement, and improved academic performance and attendance. So does any mentoring program have the same effects? Not really. There is research that's looking at what makes a really good program, and it's not just any mentoring relationship that's going to do this. You can't just find somebody who's willing to do it, put them in the same room with a kid, and say, see you in a year, hope everything goes well. There are a lot of different pieces to creating a good mentoring program that's going to make the difference. I like this quote from a researcher. Could someone else read that aloud, please? Anyone? Exactly. So you can't just start. There are lots of programs that I work with that say, well, we got some funding. We're going to launch next week. Oh, well, what have you done? Well, we found some people. We're ready to go next week. You need to back up and start looking at some really important steps. These are up here. I'm not going to read through them all, but the most important ones I want to point out today, time commitment and relationship duration and closure. If there is a closure, so you can have a positive closure experience so that these young people aren't left hanging wondering, what happened to my mentor? They said they were going to call. I haven't heard from him in like 6 months. I guess it was something about me. And post-match training, monitoring, and support. I'll talk a little bit more about that too. So what happens when it's not a good program? We find that it actually has the opposite effect of what we were intending. And talking about trust that Linda was mentioning earlier, with another failed relationship, that even further erodes that young person's trust in adults and other people around them. This is a great chart from some research done with a one-to-one, one-year commitment mentoring program from a researcher. They looked at competence at school, competence and attendance at school, pro-social behaviors, and abstinence from drugs and alcohol, and they measured the zero across the top is baseline. That's where these mentees were when they started. If the match lasted less than 6 months, they measured them. If the match lasted between 6 to 12 months, they did another measurement. And if it lasted longer than 12 months. So what does this chart tell you? Say that again?
You need to make a year-long commitment.
You need to make a year-long commitment. Why? You'll have some positive impacts, right? But more importantly, you're avoiding this huge negative impact that happens when a young person comes into, an adult comes into that young person's life and says, I'm here for you, I'm gonna be here for you for at least a year, and then they just drop out. So if you're going to be a mentor, you really need to be a mentor. And if it's not the right time, that's okay. Take the time you need, get to a place that, where you're at, where you can make that commitment. Some recommended best practices are in here. Some evidence-based best practices, and I'll point out that some of the important ones are to start with targeting the children and youth most likely to benefit. If you're working with young people who really can't form relationships with people, may not be the best candidate for a mentoring program. They may need some other kinds of support, maybe some therapeutic work, something else to get them to that point, because we're talking about these are volunteers. These are not highly trained people who are trying to form a relationship. And if you have a young person who's just completely shut off for the entire match, that's not really a good match. And also using rigorous screening and training processes for mentors. You're looking for both safety and effectiveness. I'll keep going. Some promising practices that we've seen in our program, making sure that young people know that their participation is voluntary. We've had, we take referrals from youth professionals. We've had some young people refer to our program from their probation officers who say, you need to participate in one of these three programs, pick which one. And sometimes they'll pick ours because it seems the least amount of work to do, and it's not going to work. If they're being forced to be in a mentoring program, they're not really going to be open to being in a relationship. Okay. How much time do I have? A couple minutes? Okay. Some special considerations when you're working with youth who've been in the foster care system and mentoring. It's a little bit of a different kind of lens that you want to put to what you're doing, a little bit of a different focus. So you're really looking to promote permanency. Mentoring with young people in foster care can be really transformative for them because they may go through 15, 20 different caseworkers, maybe just as many placements in different homes and going back and forth to group homes, different kinds of schools. But if they have one person who's there to just hang out with them and get to know what's happening with them, that can be a really, really engaging and lifelong experience for them. It changes their nature of relationships. You need to train staff and the mentors about issues unique to youth in the foster care system and what the system is like. Why suddenly they go to pick up their mentee from one place and then the following week they're living someplace else? And what happened to their belongings and who's in charge and why isn't anyone returning these calls and how come they can't see their brother or sister? You want to make sure your mentors are equipped to know exactly what's happening with that. Understanding shifting family dynamics. The trend is now going towards not removing young people from their homes, but supporting that family. So how is that going to work with a mentor who walks in? And how are the parents or caregivers going to feel when here's somebody else who walks in and wants to be a part of their child's life? Reaching out to them, but avoiding stigmas and labeling. You don't want to have a foster care mentoring program. That might be a little too hard for them to want to be a part of. So coming up with really great names is a way to talk about your services is important. And addressing emancipated related needs and services, and also support the mentoring's understanding of these issues too. So a mentor may not be the right person to go to for certain issues, but maybe there are other support services involved that the mentor can reach out to in addition to the program connecting. And I also want to say that I've attended a number of different panels of young people who've been in mentoring relationships. And one I went to a few years ago was the mentees were all from the foster care system. And it's really interesting to hear what they have to say about what mentoring was like for them. And by and large, if they have a really effective mentor, they have amazing experiences. And they'll say things like, I never even knew that my mentor was not paid to be with me. Because a lot of young people think, well, you're going to hang out with me. You're here. Somebody told you to do this, right? Or you're getting paid to do this, so let's go to the ballpark. Let's go hang out. Let's go. All right, let's do it. And they're actually surprised to hear, wait a minute, you're volunteering? You want to hang out with me? It's a really interesting, different, you know, it's a different way of looking at it. And then another thing that that I thought was important was a young woman said that when her first mentor came to meet her, she walked in and acted as if she knew everything about her life. So she started relaying her history. Oh, I know that this happened to you, and this happened to you, and this is what you're doing. And the mentee was like, how do you know my business? This is not okay with me. And she never formed a connection with her mentor. She was like, I don't want anything to do with this lady. This is not all right. So mentors need to take the time to, it's good to give them a little bit of information up front to know what, you know, a little bit of history of that young person, but not to kind of tell them, let your mentee tell you on his or her own time. Let them set the parameters of the relationship and share what they want to when they're ready. Okay, I feel like I'm going through this really fast. This is one of our resources connected to what we felt was a good connection to this conference, is helping programs know who they're looking for in terms of effectiveness and safety, like I talked about. This is our guide. We started doing a lot of training on this at least 10, 12 years ago. This is Becky Cooper, our executive director. She started a lot of the work involved with our child screening mentor screening practices. Back when there wasn't even fingerprinting. So we did some work with the San Jose Police Department, their first child exploitation unit officers who came in and helped us really understand what are we looking for when we have a mentor who comes in, an applicant who comes in wanting to be a mentor and is really there for the wrong reasons. We're set up in the expo hall and I have some books over there and flyers if you're interested in more of that. And we also offer trainings to other programs to make sure they're putting into place best practices. We also have a conference next week. And then I also included other kinds of resources. So if you're interested in starting a mentoring program or if you're part of one, you'll have that to refer to. Okay.
Thank you, Sarah. Help on Child's been around for 17 years. We're really going to be relying upon Friends for Youth in the development of a very specific targeted mentor program. We're not going to try and send people out as many programs do. I think it's rather horrifying how many mentoring programs just match you up and send you out without any sort of guideline, without a journal, without a program to follow. And so, in all honesty, we're at the cusp of creating that, and we will look to them for the best practices and for their knowledge and to weave in the attachment piece that is so important for these children and for the mentor themselves. There's a reason why you reach out to do this work. It's inside you already. Another aspect of what we do, mentoring is a big commitment, which you just heard. It's a year commitment.
At least.
Thank you. And Help One Child has opportunities for people to volunteer with children on our premises, at churches that we work with, offering special ed to parents, offering a parent a night out, and we play games with kids, things that we do. These are great ways to see, hey, how do I do with a kid if you haven't been around one lately? Probably better to enter into the system that way. So I invite you to contact Help One Child. You'll find all our contact information within this brochure, this handout. And let us help you find the best way for you to get plugged in. And if you'd like to be a part of creating this mentoring program and task force, we would welcome your participation. Now, with respect to this education task force, we really want to target children in group homes. We want to bring education and mentor opportunities to the children who are living there. They don't have the luxury of a parent who will drive them someplace else. They're not going to be required to be in a mentoring program. You might sit down in front of, 4 to 6 group home residents and find just one who wants to be a mentor or one that might be interested in the information that you have to offer. But we really do need to know that it is really important to just help one child at a time. We want to be able to, and we'll be putting together and offering this summer this task force curriculum. And basically it's going to be based on in your heart when you're vulnerable. You know that you've created boundaries around yourself to protect yourself. And you need to be able to look back and rely upon your own intuition. We all know when we're in the presence of something or a circumstance that just doesn't feel right. And sometimes we forget. We try to make logic be what we pay attention to. It says the need for logic dismisses our intuitive sense. It would be like if you woke up to a room filled with smoke and you just went over and opened the window and then went back to bed. To ignore those inner feelings that we have. Getting in touch with feeling is something that is a rigorous exercise for an at-risk teen. They've had a lifetime of putting their feelings, stuffing them, not honoring them, and not feeling safe expressing them. So to work with them, you've got to really be willing to have them come right up in your face. And so the training and the encouragement that you have to be just dogged about, it's just not for everyone. We want to teach them a little bit about what predators look like. How does a predator interview a possible victim? How does that actually happen out there in the world? Because these kids, when they're runaways, they're drawn to people. They're just drawn to this kind of individual. The kind that says, hey, you've got to, I didn't like the way, do you like the way that clerk looked at us? Man, forced teaming. Wow, what's up with that? Here, let me help you with that. Let me take that bag for you. Let me help you up the stairs with that. Teaching them, did I ask for this person to help me? Is this something I solicited? You know, learning to look out for themselves. What are going through? What are the types of nagging feelings? What are the senses of intuition that we need to pay attention to? You know, how do we respond to somebody who's in our space? This is kind of an example on a broad-based level for those of you that are just kind of interested in you know, what might this look like in your own home? If you have a contractor in, somebody comes into your house, you know, these are the kinds of questions that you ask. This is kind of information. You know, we don't get a lot of information. We don't get a lot of education about how to be safe in the world or how to be a good parent or how to be a good kid. You know, it kind of comes in the aftermath. So these are our action items. We really welcome you to, did I have a slide that I missed? Oh my goodness, do we not have? Yes, no, okay. Look on the back of your action items because now I've got my PowerPoint here. We invite you first and foremost for questions about what we've talked about anything that's come up over the course of this morning. Yes.
One of the things that was mentioned was when children are in foster care, they have transitioned from several different caseworkers throughout that process. If we know that's going, why is it a consistent pattern? And as a part of bridging with your group, why isn't there advocacy against that? Because that's a traditional turnover, never a stable relationship.
Yeah, for some kids, the social worker is the most stable relationship. I have to mention that, just because I don't think that that is a given. And that laws have been put into effect that limit how often a child can be moved. But the system's very imperfect. Do you want to speak to that at all? You know, you said it, Sarah.
It doesn't make any sense. We all know that. I recently was working with a family who had fostered a 14-month-old for 12 of the 14 months of life, was going on to the fifth social worker. Mm-hmm. So they truly were the most stable people in her life.
Yeah, I think that oftentimes, you know, what we find, you know, Help One Child's focus is on the family that is raising the child. The child has a lot of advocates. The family has almost none. The social worker is very, really not concerned about the family who's caring for the child. They weren't even invited to court. Just now are beginning to receive notices about the child that's living with them 24/7, what the judge and that CASA worker is going to be recommending. They're not talking to the family. Yes.
One of the biggest problems is finding good foster families.
Absolutely.
And if there's anything that could be done to recruit more and more stable foster families who are not just in it for the money, that would make a huge.
Well, that is exactly what Help One Child does. We recruit through Christian churches, and we recruit a lot of families. Let me just say, in Santa Clara County, today there are 250 empty foster homes. Empty. Children are not coming into care, and they're coming into care with families that will say, I will be a concurrent parent. Now, as a parent, you can imagine, I'd be willing to adopt this child, but you could also remove this child tomorrow. What kind of a push-pull is that? There need to be foster families who will take kids on a short-term basis and foster-adopt families that will adopt those that are on the fast track for adoption. Yep.
It's just appalling.
Yeah.
So she's just rotated in and out.
They move people around. It's a lot of reorganization, especially in the big counties.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Another, I'm not from this area, but another area, issue down there is that when the foster, there aren't enough foster homes, so the child is moved out of the county, in which case they have rotated social workers. They never have the same. they're almost all of them are getting locating social workers that never see them consistently because they're not kept in the county of San Barbara because there aren't enough homes.
There aren't enough homes.
Is like the biggest, I really think the biggest thing that churches can do is to offer, is to try to build up people that are willing to take kids in.
Yes, and you have to be able to collaborate with your local county. If the local county wants you to recruit, that's great. But if what makes their business affordable is by giving them to a relative who doesn't have the wherewithal to even ask for a stipend, because you know, $450 a month is the average cost. No one's doing it for the money. Are you kidding me? These kids are troubled. They have bigger needs. You pay more to board your dog for a month. I mean, it's just peanuts. So it is difficult to work within the government structure. I don't fault them. So know so many social workers that are just have hearts of gold and must be just so frustrated with the system. That's correct. Not as many. This time last year, Santa Clara County, as an example, had 2,200 children in foster care. At this time, there are 1,200, and it's reducing monthly. So the homes are being emptied.
Because they're being adopted or because they're being transferred?
Because they're being transferred and they're given to relatives. Mm-hmm. They're not coming into care. This is the number of kids that come into care every year. There's that many kids that come into care every year. They're getting wraparound services, family maintenance. So I think actually there could be a percentage of that that's good, that's really good. There's a lot of people that really need parent education and support, and there are good organizations that are providing that, but there's not enough agencies that are licensed for wraparound services to make it feasible to get to all the kids that need them. That's why we think the runaway population is going to be increasing. The other thing with foster homes is that people want small children. Hard enough to raise your own teenager, let alone somebody who's really pissed off and mad about the path they've been on. You have to really be willing to put your face in that.
I think a big issue that the studies that have come out in the last 10 years have shown that foster care it's not a beneficial program. It's the numbers are coming out just the same, right? Just like you said, 100% of the survivors have been in foster care. You know, so what came first? Was it the family abuse or was it the foster care system and the moving and changing of social workers? So it's a dual-edged sword. You know, you're staying in an abusive home, but we find that most kids that go in foster care usually run back home to those homes because that's the kin. So, I mean, it's a dual-edged sword, so you have to keep that into consideration, too. It's not necessarily that the numbers are decreasing because they're going to try and they're moving into the new wave of doing family care and all that because they want to see if that be more beneficial because taking the kid out of the homes is shown that it's not increasing 80% of, you know, like you said, 80% of people in jail and foster care kids.
I know it. And if it was a matter of, I think for those families that are capable of learning and are interested and committed, that is a better way to go, there's no question. But you listen to what Linda had to say about attachment. This is happening early in these children's lives. You know, by the time the child by the time a neighbor has called, what, a dozen times to CPS to get a call answered?
The average, in Santa Clara County, the average time is 7 times before kids move from the house.
Right.
CPS calls.
Right. Well, Sarah, why don't you let us know typically what your training program looks like as it stands today?
There are a couple different ways that we provide mentor training depending upon the goals of the program and the youth population that you're working with. So it would be anywhere from a half day to maybe a day and a half of training. So we haven't gotten quite there working that out, but that's something we're going to be working on. But the training would really give you a lot of skills needed to be able to form a good connection. So we talk about communication, setting limits and boundaries. We do role plays. There's a lot of good information about that.
Mostly ongoing.
We want to make sure. Go ahead.
Thank you for reminding me. Ongoing training is really important too.
Yeah.
That will also be provided.
And that's pretty much what I wanted to say, is that we want to provide the foundation and then stay in touch and make sure there is a curriculum that people are working through and the wherewithal to be able to come back and get feedback and get questions answered. Absolutely. There's as Sarah said, there's a extensive process to qualify to become a mentor. It's not for everyone.
Is there ongoing monitoring, and what does that look like? Because you can have people that can pass all of those things and it's a thumbs up, and they end up perpetrating.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there are different, our recommendation for most programs, and again, we haven't worked out the specifics for Help One Child, that is at least once a week with a mentor for the beginning stage of the relationship, maybe up to about 3 or 4 months, at least once a month with the young person, and then after 3 or 4 months, you can go to about 2 times a month to check in with the mentor and continuing on with the mentee, as well as the family or caregiver. If there's anyone else important in that relationship, they need to be checked in with too to see what their impressions are, because you're absolutely right. There are a very small number of people who can pass an application process because they know how to do it, or they haven't been caught yet. And unless you're really paying attention to the red flags that come up with ongoing monitoring, you're not going to know that any kind of abuse is happening. It's a very small number, but it's definitely something to be concerned with, and it's something that should keep you up at night, too.
The first step with Help One Child is you are oriented to our organization, to our ministry. And then you work on our premises with children. We watch you working with children. We get to know you. We're not connecting. We have no intention of connecting people instantaneously. There's too much risk for you and for them.
I just want to say that our time is up. We can continue to talk. If you are going to go, because the lunch is going on, could you please sign and put your name in a really legible email for us? Be great. And if you didn't get a handout, I've got more. I'll be over here.
Thank you.
More of a straightforward, this is
to be, it's going to be a straightforward curriculum that gives them, you know, the information that they need without trying to get therapists to work through the issues. Okay. So part of the curriculum will be their a questionnaire that they fill out. What's their response? What are the things that came up for them when they heard this information? Then we take them, and we decide who is best suited for next steps.
Yeah, I work with Sanctuary Maids in Monaco down south. We have about 20 foster children that come to our programs, and I'm just learning more about